We're starting a show now called The Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests, or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com. We start today's show with a story by the extraordinary Mike Bone called Promotion. And then I give a talk on the need for architecture. Then I interview Amber Moore, intimacy and consent educator. Also, we'll hear musical interludes from an album called Deep Breakfast by Ray Lynch. This album was very popular in the 1980s, and one of the first great albums using electronica. Stay tuned.
The owner of GRC, my employer, was Mike Thieves, the porno king. Mike got on the wrong side of the law and wound up in jail. Porno in the 70s was a bad thing. Porno in the 70s in Georgia was a very bad thing. Mike went to jail for interstate transportation of pornographic material, arson, tax evasion, all with the added blandishment of a RICO charge. Once Mike Thieves went to prison in 1975, I knew my days at GRC were numbered. Sure enough, soon after Mike went to jail, GRC was closed. I was unemployed for the first time since college. I applied to Georgia State in Atlanta for their graduate program. I was going to get an MBA. I was living on unemployment and prepping for grad school when the phone rang one night. It was a call from Cliff Bernstein at Mercury Records in Chicago. Cliff hired me to be his replacement as the head of rock promotion at Mercury Records. When I got to Chicago in late 1975, we had an Irish band on the label named Thin Lizzy. Lizzy had three albums already released, the latest being Fighting. There was a song on Fighting called Wild One, sort of a power ballad about the Irish refugees from the potato famine. The Fighting album was over. It had been worked and had had some minor success, but I thought Wild One was a hit, so I started working it on a few markets in the Midwest. Mercury had a great sales guy at the time named Harry Losk. Harry and I would get together in the evenings about 7 p.m. for gin and tonics in my office. I told Harry my plan and the markets, and he went after getting some stock in the local record stores in Chicago, St. Louis, Kansas City, Minneapolis, and Milwaukee. He bought some positioning for the Fighting album in these five markets. Four of the five markets reacted favorably to the record, and we began selling copies of Thin Lizzy's Fighting album. Not a lot, but enough to know that there was something there. Raising this album from the dead put me in good standing with the British record company Phonogram and their head of international, Russ Curry, and the A&R person that signed the band, Nigel Grange, and the band's management, Chris Morrison, Chris O'Donnell. I was a hero in their eyes. I was Mr. Thin Lizzy within Mercury Records USA. The next Thin Lizzy album, Jailbreak, was released in the spring of 1976. The single, The Boys Are Back in Town, peaked at number 12 on the Billboard Hot 100. The band exploded, and I was Mr. Thin Lizzy. Mercury was home to rockers Bachman Turner Overdrive, Thin Lizzy, Rush, 10cc, Graham Parker, Max Webster. I had a good rock roster to work with. I was introduced to the Boomtown Rats by their A&R person, Nigel Grange, the senior A&R person at Phonogram UK. Nigel had signed Thin Lizzy, 10cc, and Graham Parker was hot as pepper pudding at the time. He came to Mercury Records headquarters in Chicago and brought the Boomtown Rats lead singer Bob Geldof and the band's manager Hoffner O'Kelly. Geldof is a very interesting guy. He had a rubber stamp that said Boomtown Rats. After Mercury executives had left the office for the day, Geldof went into everyone's private office and conference room and stamped Boomtown Rats on everyone's papers and gold and platinum disc awards. Needless to say, this created a lot of interest in the company and the band, some good and some not so good. I came up with the idea of sending out dead rats with promotional copies of the album to radio stations. I thought this was in keeping with the rats' screw it attitude. I contacted a biological supply house in Wisconsin. It turns out you can get rats, cats, dogs, worms, monkeys, even human cadavers. I ordered 50 dead rats sent to my office. The rats were double bagged in formaldehyde, but they still had a sort of laboratory smell about them. The senior officials at Mercury Records were appalled that I was attempting to do something this crass. My feeling was I was in the record business, crass by definition. Nigel, Faulkner, and Geldof thought it was a great idea. The general manager of the company came into my office and gave me strict instructions not to send these rats to radio stations. So I sent the rats to a record store in Chicago on Clark Street. The record store created a window display using the dead rats and the Boomtown Rats album covers and posters. The display was such a major success that old line MOR station WGN's morning show jock Roy Leonard did a segment about the disgusting window display. This story was on the number one rated station in Chicago, a 100,000 watt clear channel radio station heard in 8 states. The WGN story created traffic jams in front of the record store to the extent that the record store had to hire off-duty policemen to handle the traffic. People were driving into Chicago from Indiana to see this disgusting window display. The press got wind of the dead rat promotion, and the story developed a life of its own. People were calling and begging for a rat. Playboy magazine referred to me as a promotional genius for coming out with this stunt. I think that might have been a little tongue-in-cheek, but who knows. Later, Geldof wrote that the dead rat promotion had killed his career in America. Hindsight is dirt cheap. At the time I was doing the promotion, Geldof thought it was fantastic. Age makes people more conservative. The punk movement had yet to gain traction in the United States. Radio consultants were coming into power and controlling what album stations were programming, and consultants avoided anything associated with punk like the Ebola virus. The Boomtown Rats were lumped in with the Sex Pistols. Neither got the airplay they deserved in the United States at the time. Sir Bob Geldof went on to do great things. Nigel was one of my best mates and lived 5 blocks from me in Santa Monica. Nigel passed away in June 2017. Faulkner O'Kelly went on to manage Sinead O'Connor, and she shaved my head once, but that's a different story.
Both of my kids went to a school in Santa Monica that didn't draw in students geographically, but rather ideologically. In other words, going there wasn't determined by where you lived, but rather by parents being interested in the philosophy of the place. It was an alternative school. The alternative school approach is supposed to have a more open structure than normal, and came from a book written in 1960 about a pioneering school in England called Summerhill. Teaching methods were more relaxed, students called teachers by their first name, and parent participation was central. The alternative school we went to was called SMASH, Santa Monica Alternative School House. In actuality, it was the school the artsy hippie families sent their children to. So, to begin with, all the families were somewhat cut from the same cloth, not merely people who happened to live near each other. One other lucky factor in the success of the school was its architecture. It was all housed in a few old run-down buildings. Well, it certainly wasn't the shabby buildings that helped the cause. Rather, it was how they were laid out. We drive our cars into the central playground in the morning, park, and walk our children into the yard where they'd enter one of several classrooms. This quirk of layout meant that all the parents ran into each other every morning. Every day, we all met on that cracking asphalt with long faded yellow tetherball court outlines and got to know each other. Someone set up a bagel and coffee stand, and parents would hang out for a while and chat. A community grew up because of the incidental architecture of the school that pushed us all together and caused us all to become friends. That inspired one parent to start a drama club. Another one, me, put on annual talent shows and camping trips, leaving behind many fond memories of school. The families at SMASH became very close, and parent participation was strong. Because of this involvement, the education was superior. It was noticed when students needed extra help, and they received it. It was noticed when teachers needed extra help, and they received it. And because of the drama programs, talent shows, camping trips, art and computer clubs, and other fun extras for the students to participate in, the school felt like a nice place to be. Because we all met in the mornings in front of those run-down classrooms, education was enhanced. After a few years, I noticed that practically all my friends were connected to my kids' school. And truly, there's a direct line from having that place to act on my impulse to host talent shows and organize camping trips to what I'm now doing professionally. Organizing and hosting radio shows. I explain all this to recognize the importance of architecture. This is not some random technology unrelated to our lives. It is the canvas that we create our lives on. Architecture, by the way, is considered one of the great subdivisions of the arts, along with sculpture, painting, literature, music, performing, and film. Ever been to the great cities of Europe? We can design cities that are not just functional, but are also artful, even beautiful. Not that our cities in the United States are currently functional. We've had to go numb in order to survive living in these sewers of ugliness, making us lose cognizance of how badly our psyche is damaged by urban blight. Our cities have looks that kill. we've lost all awareness of how the jumble of wires, ads, traffic, and concrete cubes etch dullness onto our brains. As we live our isolated lives in little boxes made out of ticky-tacky. On the bright side, if you live in a bleak, lonely box long enough, you can get used to it. Once upon a time, Chinese, Middle Eastern, East Indian, and American empires built breathtaking cities like Teotihuacan to mirror the heavens. Future archaeologists will not be able to determine the cycle of the moon and sun by the layout of our 21st century metropolises, but they will learn the densest way humans can be crammed into cheap rectangular housing containers. Here's a radical notion. Have architecture facilitate contact between human and human, and human and nature, and human and art. Technology should bring us closer to beauty. The natural world should meander right up to our front doors. Buildings should enable fellowship, just like what happened at my kids' school. But citywide or countrywide? No, worldwide. What if skyscrapers were sky sculptures and cities were people preserves? We found out during the lockdown that when neighbors play music on front porches, the sound of the city gets sweeter, and people living next door to each other finally meet each other. How is it that we think nothing of blaring car horns, screaming jet planes, and grating leaf blowers, yet it's peculiar to hear people singing outside? No one thinks it's an outrage when a new apartment building goes up or there's a remodel, but these projects mean months of loud construction noise and banging for dozens of folks living nearby. Studies show that people living near airport noise have higher suicide rates. Do we really need more studies to inform us of the importance of peaceful domicile? What's one of the first things people say they love about traveling to the wilderness? They love the peace and quiet. Cities could be designed so that noisy parts are distant from living, recreation, and repose parts. Why wouldn't communities be designed for people to connect and relax? Why isn't well-being and quality of life the top priorities? Otherwise, what's the point? As it turned out, Smash moved to a brand new building near the end of my family's tenure there. It had bright lighting and new fixtures and the latest classroom technology. It must have been designed by a reputable architect, and did indeed have an artful, innovative design. It was decidedly not the default post-war squat, drab, uniform beige units that were standard for schools built in the 50s and 60s. But in this new building, there was no place for parents to meet in the morning. The drop-offs were quick because the family behind you was waiting to let their children out. But this bright and shiny new school wasn't able to do what dumpy old Smash's accidental design did: enable community. In a few months, I could see the connections between families start to weaken, which is when we happened to exit. On the occasion of a later visit a couple years later, I could see that Smash had become what I knew schools to always be: a place for learning math, science, and English, while it still had a philosophical connection, its architectural loss meant a loss of a kind of enchantment. Architecture is a thing. City planning, the way an entire city is laid out, is an even more important thing. At the largest levels, state and national infrastructure and transportation policy and funding are what knits all of society together. The way the playing board is laid out matters. This is Mystic Pete. It is May 28th, 2021. I have Amber Amore in studio. Amber Amore is an extraordinary person, a spokesperson, business person, musician, dating coach, author, activist, holistic healer, model. She hosts retreats, and she's a consent and intimacy educator. Hi, Amber Amore.
Hi.
I'm sure you do 20 other things. I mean, just an extraordinary being. What did I miss? Tell me more about yourself.
Well, thank you for such a wonderful introduction. I was like hearing the list and I was like, wow, yeah, I do all those things. My main focus right now is just helping survivors of sexual assault. And I've used a lot of different mediums to do this. So I've used activism, online education, workshops, chalk art, books, you name it, even retreats. And, you know, my focus is that community because I'm a survivor of sexual assault as well. And I can deeply identify with that group of people and that community. And I would also like to give a trigger warning at this time, just to let people know that this will be our topic for today. So stay tuned if you're able to listen and willing to learn something new. And I can always come back later if you need to take a break.
So we're going to be discussing things very frankly, and it may be intense for some people, but this is important information that people really need to hear to keep people safe.
Absolutely. And so that people can heal, because when people hear other people's stories, it inspires them to go within and to do their own healing work. It allows them to confront their past as well. So there's a lot of value in hearing from other survivors, listening to them, and believing them so that you can undo all of that rape culture programming that all of us have been programmed with.
Yes. Well, can we start by you telling a little bit about your background? And then I want to actually get into a little bit more how society is approaching this, dealing with it or not dealing with it.
Absolutely. So my background is in activism. I've been an activist since I was like 12 years old. My first protest was the war in Iraq, and my mother took me. So she is an activist as well. And I have always been very passionate about helping others. You know, when I was a little kid, I just wanted to save the world. And it got very clear on with, you know, the community that I wanted to help with the most when I became a survivor of sexual abuse when I was 12. So ever since then, I just have had a fire in my heart to help other survivors of sexual assault by teaching them that they can heal, by teaching them about consent, so that all of us can create a culture of consent. And outside of that, I was a French major in school. So I actually lived in Paris, France for 5.5 years. I moved there when I was 18. And just hopped around Europe a lot while I was in college. That really opened me up, being from Ohio, you know, and moving straight to France. It was a very powerful cultural experience for me. And ever since then, it has inspired me to just keep traveling around the world as I do this activism. So it's been a really good journey.
And by the way, your website is amberamore.com and also ancestralessentials.com. You have products you sell.
Yes, I sell spiritual products for any person who wants to cleanse their aura and raise their vibration. So that's what all my work is about, is spirituality, healing, and, you know, whatever it is that we need to do to overcome our inner demons.
You bring in the whole spiritual flow. Well, you know, Mystic Pete here, so we're in the right company.
Yes.
So let's expand a little bit now to this issue of consent and safety and empowerment. And what is our culture in general doing right or doing wrong?
Well, we can talk about what society is doing wrong first, and then we'll talk about the positives. Survivors of sexual assault are not authentically supported. So society is not supporting survivors of sexual assault in the way that they need to be. because survivors of sexual assault are rarely believed, and they're often blamed and questioned when they speak up. And it's even worse for men and people in the LGBTQ community as well. There's even more stigma when it comes to them speaking up. So there's too much like blame and not enough understanding. That is what's wrong with society right now, is people are pointing the fingers at survivors and not at the people who are taking these actions. So that is one way society can change, is to change their mentality on what a survivor looks like and how a survivor behaves. Because every single survivor is gonna have a different reaction to the trauma that they've gone through. And there's no such thing as a perfect victim. You know, the perfect victim is what we all imagine is like a person getting sexually assaulted at night, usually a female jogger, and this happens by a stranger. And then people imagine that this woman would shut down and, you know, become super depressed, not tell anyone. And of course, that is normal, and that is a normal side effect of being sexually assaulted. However, there's also survivors who deal with their pain in completely different ways. And society needs to start understanding that some people don't shut down after sexual assault. Some people just go about their lives and pretend everything is just fine. I know I've done that. And another thing that some survivors can do is like some people will be super closed down when it comes to sex and just turned off by the idea of sex. And other people want to have more sex so that they can like reclaim their bodies and use that as a tool of empowerment and healing by giving authentic consent. So there's different ways that survivors deal with their pain. Some people just totally suppress it. Some speak up about it. But either way, we're judged. So it's really important to just have that unconditional love and compassion. When a person is speaking up about a trauma that they've been through, they're telling you because they feel like they need support and that you could be a great person to support them. And so it's important to just put aside all judgment and really be there for them when they do speak up. So that's one thing society can do differently, is just believe survivors and have more compassion. And then also society needs to change the laws. You know, right now the laws are not even supporting survivors of sexual assault. And even though it is illegal to sexually assault people, it's the judges and the jurors and our general public who is still operating with the mentality of rape culture, and therefore they're blaming the victims even in court. And this is why so many survivors of sexual assault don't even speak up, and the ones who do, their cases get thrown out. That happened to me twice. So I can definitely relate with, you know, any person who doesn't speak up or is not interested in speaking up, because it's an act of self-preservation. And that is something we can honor, you know, in them, that they're preserving themselves, you know, and hopefully the society will just completely change. That's my prayer, is that we will have a culture of consent where people are really heard when they speak up about sexual assault, and that there's a real actual intervention that comes in that includes perhaps a jail or whatever the court needs, you know, to help that person be out of society and away from being a danger to others.
Well, let me just interject or just reflect upon what a couple things you just said. First of all, people who say, well, I'm just not into politics. You know, I don't vote. I'm not part of that whole thing out there. The problem with that is real change in society comes through making good law. Politics, government, the Senate, laws, this is the mechanism. This is the machine where great good is done that holds people accountable, that makes sure things are fair, makes sure there's justice. So that's the place it happens. And if you're not helping make good laws, like in this particular case, that protect victims and empower women, you're not really solving the problem. I mean, you can help one or two people, but making good, strong laws, that really solves a problem in a fundamental way. I want to open that pull back the curtains on that scary thing called laws and politics. That's where the great, great deeds are done to help people. And until that is effective on that level, it really will never solve. The other point I wanted to make was that it's a complicated situation when you get assaulted and victimized. And we're not robots. Everybody responds differently. And it can be a long journey, a complicated journey. So yeah, that's a very important point. It's a mess.
It definitely makes things confusing, frightening, and there's a lot to heal after being sexually assaulted. And then, you know, it's not our fault that it happened to us. If we want to heal, then that is, you know, definitely something that makes things better.
Where are the bright spots? What's happening right now culturally that you feel is going in the right direction, where there's some sunlight coming in?
Yes. Well, I mean, there's definitely hope for a better world, because every single time a survivor speaks up, it makes the world a better place. No matter if they're speaking up to themselves by journaling about it for the first time, or they're telling a friend, a therapist, or someone with a larger platform like a politician or celebrity who speaks up. Every single person who speaks up is ultimately creating a culture of consent. That is our rainbow. You know, that's our hope and our glory, because the more people speak up, the more people are going to realize that how much an issue it is. And it's going to make the world change and a better place just by people having that knowledge. You know, the knowledge is power. And you ask, like, how can society be better? You know, those are two ways right there: by more people speaking up and by people believing survivors. You know, we have to go through unlearning rape culture. And rape culture says it's a survivor's fault. What was that person wearing? Were they drunk? Etc. So once we, like, study these types of go-to questions that we have when a survivor speaks up, that is going to help us take away any judgment, you know, and it's going to really help us just release those, you know, and have unconditional love, because that's what it's all about.
Very good point. And I think when somebody tells you about a trauma or a tragedy, like somebody says, my friend died, the first impulse of the listener is, how did they die? Like, they want to know the details to satisfy their own curiosity. So they're not asking questions to comfort the bereaved. And similarly, when somebody tells you they've been assaulted or raped, your first impulse may be to find out more information because you're curious, or maybe it's even prurient interest. But you really should be thinking of the needs of the person who's been hurt, not your own needs to milk them of information. What can you say that will support them?
Mm-hmm. Ask them what they need, how you can help, you know? But when it comes to asking more in details on how it happened, it really re-victimizes that person. It makes them feel like they're in it again.
Think of their needs.
Yes. Think of their needs.
And not your own needs to find out all the gory details.
Mm-hmm.
So let's shift the conversation a little bit to intimacy. So you're an intimacy educator, and you're very comfortable in that world too. And in some respects, it's 180 degrees opposite what we're just talking about, but it's actually the same thing. Like, to be intimate, you need to be safe, to relax and let down and to connect with somebody, there has to be good boundaries and conversation.
Yes, and safety and consent, you know, and like intimacy relates to this topic because, you know, having a safe partner who's like really consent conscious and aware of your boundaries, when you have that safe partner who just cares and is like attentive to your needs, it can definitely be very healing. So I'm really glad that you mentioned that. You know, intimacy is a huge part of healing from sexual assault. You know, when you're able and ready with the right partner, it can just be so transformative.
Help me connect the dots a little bit more now culturally. As a species, how do these things put together, like this idea of good communication and consent, and also everyone connecting together?
Well, I mean, as a species, you know, just learning how to communicate in the bedroom is going to be your best friend. Because when people communicate with each other properly, and even outside of the bedroom, because all consent culture starts outside of the bedroom. So it's about asking people for consent, for taking their picture, for, you know, sharing their photo online, for giving out their address, for giving out their private information, stuff like that. You know, if we just adapt a culture of consent outside of the bedroom, we could transfer that into the bedroom, you know, by getting it all down packed and crossing all the bases, you know. So, yeah, consent culture starts, you know, it's very vast. It's a huge topic. But when people have that consent consciousness in their relationship outside of the bedroom, it brings so much trust inside of it, too. And it makes things a lot better. So it's a very powerful thing for people to just respect people's boundaries, be mindful of what a person might not want, and verbally ask them.
Let me add an amendment here. Culturally, societally, when some fraction of, say, men are being violative and taking advantage, it makes all women more suspicious of all men. So just a few bad actors can just kind of poison the well of connectivity and intimacy. So, I mean, as a culture, we kind of need to take this on. If women are going to be able to relax as a community, and then men can relax as a community, so we kind of have to deal with this globally, ultimately, for things to let down, for dating and mating to get easier.
Yeah, I mean, it gets easier the more we learn about what creates a harmonious relationship. Because if people are like, don't even know, they're just going to keep navigating as an unhealed being and just taking themselves from relationship to relationship unhealed. And so that education on, like, okay, here's a little etiquette wouldn't hurt, you know. I feel like it could make things a lot better. Etiquette classes, you know, we don't even have to call it sex ed, you know. But if we just start with consent culture outside of the bedroom, and, you know, start there, it really does make it so much more harmonious between the sexes.
Yes. So let's now move on to a third theme that seems to run through your work, and that's spirituality. So just generally, what's the spiritual message with all of this? We've talked about the different poles of sexuality, consent and intimacy. How does spirit figure in?
Well, sex is sacred. And it is within divine order and divine law for consent culture to even exist and be. That is like our norm. Speaking divinely and spiritually, that is the norm, is consent. So our world has kind of got a little flipped upside down because we're living in, you know, a rape culture currently. But that doesn't mean that we can't change, you know. I feel like as time goes on, people are getting more spiritually enlightened and conscious. So that is helping to create a culture of consent. And also spirituality comes in with the healing, because that is the, you know, for me, it was the most effective way to heal. You know, talk therapy was not it. Antidepressants and pills were not really working for me. However, if they work, whoever they work for, then keep doing what works, because that's all that matters. You know, for me, I needed to, and I also, it was a money thing. I didn't have money for therapy when I was in college dealing with this and ready to start focusing on healing. But I did have a spiritual breakthrough, and it came after rock bottom. And in that space, I realized I didn't want to die. I didn't want to end my life. I wanted to live, and I wanted to live well and help the world. So I've seen all of the ups and highs and lows of being a survivor of sexual assault. I've seen the worst and darkest days as someone who's completely depressed. And I've also had to pull myself out of that. Over time, I healed, and my spirituality is what really took my healing to the next level. You know, I mean, for me, healing from sexual assault with spirituality looks like meditation, visualization, purification, shamanic healing, Reiki, energy healing of all types, past life regressions. Like, I went all in. I've seen shamans and curanderas and priestesses and hugans. Like, I've gone all in when it comes to the spiritual healing from sexual assault, and that has been the most transformative.
Any comments about the relationship to all this sexual breakage and the spiritual breakage that's present?
What do you mean by breakage?
Well, you say we're in a rape culture, and I'm saying there's something about us that's sexually broken. And there's also seems to be something about us that's spiritually broken.
Yes. I like that you're connecting those dots. Wow. I mean, definitely the world is just out of order. It's out of order because our natural state is peace and joy and harmony and unity. You know, if you look at nature, it just is. Even if there's a storm, that just is too. I mean, yeah. When it comes to this breakage that you're speaking of, yes, people are spiritually broken because they've forgotten divine order, divine law, and unconditional love for themselves and others. So when you don't have those elements, yes, there is going to be chaos, and it's not okay. You know, yeah. That's something we want to fix. That's what we want to bring balance back to the world. And that's what us light workers are here doing. Mystic Pete and I is bringing that light back.
And I would say that unconditional love starts with safety and consent. You can't be that vulnerable unless you feel like you're going to be cared for properly.
Unconditional love starts with consent.
Amber Amore, people can find you at amberamore.com and ancestralessentials.com. Any closing words? And then we're going to just play a recording you've made of a piece you wrote for Tiny Buddha. But go ahead.
Yes. Well, I just wanted to just give thanks for every person who is listening right now. I want to thank you for tuning in. And you can reach me at amberamour.com, amberamour.com. And my Instagram is realamberamour. And also just know, for survivors of sexual assault out there, just know that you are not alone. You can heal. And it does get better. And I just want to thank Mystic Pete for having me here, and just let everyone know that I am here for you. I'm an advocate and an adamant advocate for survivors of sexual assault of all types, all backgrounds and classes and races. And I'm an advocate for male survivors of sexual assault, LGBTQ survivors of sexual assault, and definitely sex workers. So all survivors of sexual assault get love from me. There is no judgment or discrimination in my world because we are in this together as survivors of sexual assault. And I can promise you, we are going to see a better day.
Amber Amore, thank you so much for your time today. You're doing wonderful work.
Thank you.
Greetings. My name is Amber Amore, and I'm here to read you an excerpt from my article originally published on Tidy Buddha, entitled 39 Supportive Things to Say to a Male Survivor of Sexual Assault. I just want to let you know that you are not alone. Here we go. Number one, your pain is valid. Number two, the person who did this to you is the only person to blame, not yourself. Number three, you are not less of a man for being sexually assaulted. Number four, being a survivor does not define who you are as a man. Number five, a survivor is anything but weak. Number six, don't be afraid to talk about it. Number seven, never blame yourself. Number eight, things will get better. Number nine, you are so incredibly strong. Number 10, I'm proud of you. For more from this article, feel free to search Amber Amour, A-M-O-U-R, Tiny Buddha, to see all of my articles. Have a great day.
We are coming to the end of a show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. We started the show with the extraordinary Mike Bone telling a story called Promotion, Part 2. And then I gave a talk on architecture. There were musical interludes from an album called Deep Breakfast by Ray Lynch. We heard Celestial Soda Pop, then The O of Pleasure, and lastly, Falling in the Garden. But also importantly, an extended interview with the wonderful Amber Amour intimacy and consent educator, and a short excerpt from an article she wrote in Tiny Buddha. Thank you so much for listening. Mystique Pete out.